I'm now joined by John Kim, co-founder and CEO of Panagram, who entered the ETF space back in January of last year with the launch of the Panagram Triple B2B CLO ETF, ticker symbol CLOZ. They then followed that up by launching a AAA CLO ETF, ticker symbol CLOX. And very quickly, they are finding an audience here, already up to about $340 million in assets in just over a year. John is now joining me from New York. John, it's a pleasure. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Nate. Thanks very much for having me.
So as I understand it, you previously ran the structured products group at Eldridge. And then a few years ago, you launched Panagram, which currently manages some $17 billion in assets overall. And I should note that Panagram is a subsidiary of Eldridge. But obviously, you specialize in CLOs, which you and I are going to go into in depth. But how did this all come together a few years ago with Panagram? And I'm curious what ultimately led you to launching these two CLO ETFs?
Yeah, that's a great question. As you said, we are a structured credit asset manager. We manage about $17 billion, and in 2021, we decided to spin off from our parent company, Eldridge, so that we could manage money for third parties. Along the way, when we looked at the universe of what was happening across wealth management in particular and asset management for companies like ours, we started to see that there was a need and a demand for a CLO product that was easily accessible. And before we had launched CLOZ last year, there was no easy way to for individuals to have access to CLO bonds in the mezzanine part of the capital structure, the higher yielding part of the capital structure. So given that the CLO market is quite large, it's gotten very liquid over the last few years. It's grown to over $1 trillion of outstanding bonds. There's a lot of players now, a lot of trading going on in the CLO market. We thought it was a great time to launch a liquid product that individuals could access.
Okay, so we are going to get into the ETFs and obviously the investment case here in a moment, but I always like to cover the basics. And so I'd love to have you first explain what a collateralized loan obligation is. Let's start there.
Yeah. It is the worst named product of all time because most people do confuse it with collateralized debt obligations, which of course were some of the instruments that caused quite a lot of panic and problems in the economy in 2008 and 2009. CLOs, the L stands for loans, and what that means is corporate loans. So they are institutional products based on senior secured corporate loans. They are very, very different from the instruments that blew up during the crisis several years ago. CDOs were based on subprime mortgages, as we probably know from watching The Big Short and reading articles from that time. CLOs are based on corporate loans, very diverse pools of corporate loans. So there's a key difference there because the structures are similar because they're both securitization structures. However, the underlying assets could not be more different, both in terms of safety, behavior, long-term performance. So CLOs really did fine during the financial crisis, in fact, and although they're very similarly named to CDOs, they're quite different in performance. So we've had a really long 30-year run of a very solid CLO performance through multiple crises, through a few recessions, through the pandemic, and they're going to be here to stay.
It is interesting. I think you're right. I think some investors hear CLOs and that sends an absolute shiver down their spine. They automatically think back to the global financial crisis in 2008. But to your point, that was CDOs, collateralized debt obligations. With CLOs, can you explain the tranches and just how these are structured in a little more detail?
Yeah. So you start with a pool of, very diverse pool of loans, all from different industries and issuers, right? Household names that you would know, like Dell and John Deere and so forth. And you take those loans and bundle them into one structure, and then you issue tranches against that structure. And what that means is you're just issuing a security backed by that pool of loans. The securities are usually issued sort of in a priority. You start with AAA, which is at the top of the structure, and that means you have first right of payment for interest and principal when it comes in. And then that AAA goes down through the rating structure, AAA, AA, single A, BBB, and BB. And you get paid in that order. So every time money comes into a CLO structure from the interest on the loans, it gets paid down what is called the waterfall. So you pay your AAA interest first, your AA, and so forth, until you get down to double B. If anything's left over, that goes to the CLO equity, and that's an important thing to understand about CLOs, is that even if you're a double B holder, you have some capital cushion beneath you to absorb some losses in the pool. I know that sounds very technical, but what that really means is you have a margin of safety anytime you buy a rated CLO bond. They're rated very conservatively. The performance has been really, really good. So even at the double B level, we see very low defaults historically, and a lot of protections built in for the bondholder.
And my understanding, that process you just described, so there is a CLO manager who they're managing this process. They're determining the tranches. And CLOs typically hold somewhere, what, like 200 underlying loans?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say it's we generally use the range 150 to 300, depending on the structure. So it's highly diversified. And you're right to say that there's a CLO manager, sort of choosing and trading the loans, right? Unlike most securitizations, CLOs are actively managed. And that means the manager can substitute loans in the pool and sort of reinvest any payments on the loans that come in, reinvest those in new loans. So it's a very actively managed product. I think the very important thing to understand, though, is that even though it's actively managed, these managers cannot do what they want, right? That is to say, there's a lot of rules built into CLO structures. There's diversification rules. You can't overcommit to one issuer, one industry. You have to spread it around. You can't buy a lot of distressed debt. You can't buy triple C's. So there's a lot of restrictions on what the manager can do, and the net result of those restrictions is that these CLO pools are actually quite middle of the fairway. They tend to drive loan managers to the larger, most common loans, because that's how you assemble a steady portfolio that's less volatile than the overall market.
And then one other point I just want to emphasize here before we move on, the underlying loans are typically floating rate, correct?
That is correct. The underlying loans are based on a benchmark. It used to be LIBOR, now it's SOFR. CLO debt is also floating rate. So you're matching floating rate assets against floating rate liabilities. And so as a bondholder, the advantage, obviously, of floating rate is that anytime rates go up, as they have in the last year or so, you capture all of that upside. When interest rates were zero, you were getting your credit spread on the bond. So, let's say a typical double B-rated bond would have a coupon of SOFR plus 600 basis points. So when rates are zero, you're getting 6% yield, which is pretty good. But now when rates are at 5, you're getting 11% yield, which is even better. So they do float up and down with interest rates. And what that means is, as an investor, you don't have to worry about interest rates going up or down. You're going to get a great credit spread, and you're going to capture whatever the risk-free rate is in your bond.
Okay, so in terms of the two ETFs you offer, again, the Panagram Triple B2B CLO ETF and the Panagram AAA CLO ETF, I think they're both relatively straightforward. They obviously both offer exposure to their stated CLO tranches. They're both actively managed. Anything else you would highlight here just in terms of how these ETFs are structured?
Sure. CLOZ, as you pointed out, is our mezzanine fund that is almost evenly split between triple B and double B rated bonds. So they're going to have this fund will have a higher yield than other funds in its category. I think right now the SEC yields a little over 9.6%. But we don't think that you're running a lot of undue risk. You're getting well paid for that risk in this fund, primarily because we are choosing CLO managers that we consider top tier. And what I mean by that is there's about 140 CLO managers in the U.S. universe. And I would say a handful of that, a small fraction of that, is considered really top tier. They have a lot of debt outstanding, a lot of bonds in the market, a lot of people trade them, a lot of analysis done on their deals, and a lot of bid depth in the market. So for that reason, we tend to favor tier one, especially in mezzanine, because we think the NAV will be more stable around tier one manager bonds, as opposed to chasing a little bit of yield at that level and maybe being okay with a tier two or tier three manager in that pool. CLOX is a AAA only fund. We are pure AAA. There's no double A or single A or any other kinds of bonds in there. We want that to be 100% sort of bulletproof principal protection. I know you can never guarantee that, but you know, AAA history in the CLO market is on your side because there's never been a AAA default in 30 plus years of CLO issuance. So we want that to be a rock solid fund with principal protection. And even there, you're getting a 6.5% yield or so for what we think is a good substitute for cash accounts.
We've talked about the floating rate nature of CLOs, and obviously you touched on the potential yield pickup here. I'd love to have you elaborate a bit more on the investment case for owning CLOs in a portfolio. And look, we're not here to offer specific investment advice, but perhaps you can provide at least some guidance in terms of an allocation percentage. I really just want to hone in on how investors and advisors should think about using CLO ETFs in the context of a broader portfolio.
Yeah. Well, I think CLOs are already part of many, many multi-bond sort of strategies that you might buy in a mutual fund or, you know, other format. So CLOs institutionally have been around a long time, and many money managers use them as a bit of a pickup in yield. For a pure CLO fund, we would comp it very favorably to parts of investors' high-yield portfolios. You're getting a very high yield relative to the risk you're taking, and we think in many ways, you know, with the low interest rate duration in a volatile rate environment, with the fact that these are sort of steady coupon payers on a quarterly basis, there's a lot of reason to say, well, I should consider putting at least some portion of my high-yield exposure, right? In a typical 60-40 portfolio, you might have 10% of your portfolio exposed to high yield. Some portion of that should probably be in CLOs and not as a trade, as a long-term hold, because these are very steady assets. They're good bonds to hold over a long period, and you clip a very nice coupon while you're doing that.
I know there are differing views out there, but some would look at the high-yield bond space and say, look, there's equity-like volatility there. And so when you're thinking about portfolio allocation, perhaps that should come out of the equity sleeve and not the fixed income sleeve. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, look, there's obviously some upside embedded in high yield if you have a view on rates and so forth. But I think for most investors, you would like to sort of allocate something steady and make sure that your income component is also steady. You want something that has a good premium to the risk-free rate. You don't want to just take a bet on where rates are going and then try to outpace that all the time. So, you know, to your point, choosing an entry point and an exit point for high yield is sort of like choosing an entry point and exit point for the equities market. It's very hard to time. It's hard to get it right. You have to have a very strong view, and your view may not be correct, and it's a volatile market. Here, what we're proposing is you take no interest rate risk. You sort of go where rates go, and you clip that coupon wherever the risk-free rate is. But your credit spread is actually quite robust, and therefore, you're going to get a pretty good income yield regardless of where rates go, regardless of your entry point, right? So we don't encourage people to time this market. We think that you should allocate to it as you normally would allocate to anything over time, whether you dollar cost average or whether you put a slug in at a certain point. You're going to clip a nice coupon as soon as you start doing that, and you don't have to worry so much about the volatility around it.
As it pertains to the ETFs themselves, you know, anytime I highlight ETFs on this podcast, I try to think through what may be some real concerns that investors and advisors have and not just look at what the potential benefits may be. And it's interesting because as I thought about the CLO market, and you mentioned this earlier, that the CLO market overall is very large and liquid, but I could see an investor having concerns about whether or not the market is deep enough with plenty of liquidity, because as I'm sure you're well aware, in the ETF space, we've heard for years about this potential mismatch in liquidity, right? Where you're wrapping certain corners of the fixed income universe in an ETF, and perhaps, you know, that can be an issue if there's some sort of credit crisis or whatever. Can you just talk a little bit more about the depth of the CLO market and whether or not you have any concerns, especially if you continue to grow these products the way you have over the past year?
I think it's interesting and instructive to look at what happened in the pandemic. A lot of assets had a very steep fall in March of 2020, and CLOs were no exception. But on the AAA side, the fall in price was really a few points, you know, relative to things like high yield and other asset classes in credit that sort of fell, you know, dozens of points perhaps. The mezzanine part of the structure fell temporarily for, you know, about 30 points, and it rebounded right away. So there was trading going on during that time period. There was liquidity. If you wanted to sell bonds because you were a forced seller at that time, you were able to find bidders. And in fact, there were a lot of people on the sidelines waiting to pounce on CLO bonds whenever they were tradable. And as a result, you know, very few people wanted to sell at those levels. I think that it is a very robust asset class, and the people who are trading it on the institutional side are sophisticated enough to know that there's going to be a lot of liquidity there if you need it at that time, but also that from a credit perspective, you do not need to sell these bonds in a time of stress because it's a bargain, you know, it's a bargain price, and people, you know, would rather be buyers. So I don't know if I answered your question directly, but, you know, I think the liquidity is truly there. It's there on the institutional side, and people recognize that at the large banks. For the individual investor with an ETF portfolio that, on compared to the size of the overall market, is quite small, I think the liquidity will be there in a stressed situation, if it happens.
Yeah, so just to be clear, let's say you grow your ETFs to $1 billion or $10 billion. Again, a problem you would like to have.
Sure.
It doesn't sound like you have any concerns regarding the underlying market.
I think the overall, the entire universe of CLO ETFs right now is under $10 billion, and compared to a market outstanding, of over $1 trillion. Clearly, it's not big enough to sort of move things yet. If it were to grow to multiples of where we are today, you could see ETFs sort of, at least having more influence on the CLO market and pricing in that market. But I do not believe that the liquidity profile will change very much because even with larger portfolios, it makes it more liquid, certainly for the individual investor. But in terms of trading these CLO bonds, we think the market will be able to absorb that. Remember that the market is also growing every year. It does not remain static. There's a lot of new issuance this year. They're expected to be $120 billion of new issuance or more than that this year. So the CLO market grows a little bit every year, and we think it'll continue to grow.
John, just a few minutes left here.
Sure.
Bigger picture, I'm curious, how are you viewing the overall fixed income environment right now? And I'll tell you, I've talked a lot about this recently. I think many investors were obviously expecting rates to come back in. Clearly, that hasn't happened. And you look, we've seen longer duration bond ETFs really take it on the chin this year. Even broad-based bond ETFs are negative for the year. And so I'm just curious, how are you viewing the rate environment, and what does that mean for CLOs?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not a rate specialist, but, you know, we have thought here at Panagram for a long time that, inflation is a lot more embedded than anyone wanted to admit. And we're seeing that now in the data. Inflation is very stubborn. We saw employment numbers this morning that clearly were quite strong in terms of wage growth and so forth. And that just indicates that the Fed is in a bit of a bind and may not be able to lower rates anytime soon. Now, I made the point earlier that as a CLO bond investor, you don't necessarily care where rates go as long as you're clipping a good spread over the risk-free rate. But that being said, if rates are higher for longer, you are capturing all of that rate that rate strength in your bond if you hold a CLO bond. And that's why a fixed-rate bond is more volatile in terms of price and also is harder to time. It's harder to get right because you can't really tell where rates are going to go tomorrow. And I think we're at a point now where it's conceivable, maybe not probable, but conceivable that rates could actually go up from here. And so if you're worried about that scenario, I think CLOs are a good place to again, allocate a part of your income portfolio because you will capture that rate move in your income. And if rates go down, you're still capturing a great credit spread. So you're in our minds, you are in either scenario, clipping a very, very good risk-adjusted yield.
I think all of that makes perfect sense. But let me ask you this. Let's say rates do go up, or let's just say we have this higher for longer scenario. Doesn't that make it more difficult for some of these companies to service their debt? And if so, isn't that a concern for the lower rated CLO tranches?
Yes, it's a real concern, and we obviously have monitored that. You know, the entire CLO industry monitors the strength and the liquidity of the underlying loan pools very carefully. You know, look, today everyone expected a very large spike in defaults due to the rate hikes, and we have not seen it. Right now, loans are currently defaulting at a 1.2% rate, and that's completely normal. When you look at the historical performance of leveraged loans, we thought, you know, and people thought it was going to go up to 3 or 4%. We just have not seen that materialize. And I think the core reason is that most companies in this space have managed to pass along their costs up until now to the end users, the end consumers, or the companies they service. If rates go up further, clearly there's going to be more stress on these companies in terms of excess. And so we will monitor that default rate very carefully. But as a CLO bondholder, remember, you have cushion beneath you, as I was saying before. When you structure a CLO, even at the BB level, you have about $8 out of 100, you know, in capital beneath you. And that $8 would need to erode completely before you're exposed to a first loss. And that, I won't say it never happens, it does happen, but it happens at a rate that is far, far lower than you would expect for a BB bond. BB bonds historically have performed much, much better than their rating. So although we are concerned about the default rate, we know that CLOs can absorb a significant amount of defaults before anything happens to the rated bonds. And that's one of the structural features that I think if we can get people to understand that, they will realize they're in a position of strength with regard to where rates are going.
John, before I let you go, going back to the two ETFs, I have to ask you, I saw that a portion of the management fees on those is being donated to MMCC, which provides education and enrichment programs to Bronx and Manhattan residents. I'm just curious, why is that cause near and dear to your heart?
Yeah, so it's a great organization. I encourage people to go and see what they do at mmcc.org. When we started Panagram, we wanted to have an ESG policy that reflected the views of its employees. So we did several surveys and polls about where people wanted to direct some of our charitable giving, some of our support. And one of the overwhelming things that came out of that was people wanted local impact organizations. We did we interviewed a number of people. We came upon the great people at MMCC. It's run by a wonderful woman named Rita Santelia, and they've been working in the Bronx for 30 plus years. This is a center that provides an immense variety of services to local residents here in New York City. It's a great partnership. We love working with them. We do a lot of volunteer work at their organization, and part of our fees goes to support their work.
That's fantastic. I love seeing stuff like that. So congratulations to you on that, and congratulations on the success of these ETFs thus far. Really interesting market here in CLOs, and I thought you did an excellent job of explaining everything. So best of luck to you, John, and thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much, Nate. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
That was John Kim, co-founder and CEO of Panagram.